Chapter 40. Deny me not, I beseech you, so slight a boon. Talk not to me, O my reverend friend, of Carwin. He has told thee his tale, and thou exculpatest him from all direct concern in the fate of Wyland. This scene of havoc was produced by an illusion of the senses. Be it so, I care not from what source these disasters have flowed. It suffices that they have swallowed up our hopes and our existence. What his agency began, his agency conducted to a close. He intended, by the final effort of his power, to rescue me, and to banish his illusions from my brother. Such is his tale, concerning the truth of which I care not. Henceforth I foster but one wish. I ask only quick deliverance from life, and all the ills that attend it. Go, wretch. Torment me not with thy presence and thy prayers. Forgive thee? Will that avail thee, when thy fateful hour shall arrive? Be thou acquitted at thy own tribunal, and thou needest not fear the verdict of others. If thy guilt be capable of blacker hues, if hitherto thy conscience be without stain, thy crime will be made more flagrant by thus violating my retreat. Take thyself away from my sight, if thou wouldst not behold my death. Thou art gone, murmuring and reluctant. And now my repose is coming, my work is done. Fitz James O'Brien, the golden ingot, I had just retired to rest, with my eyes almost blind with the study of a new work on physiology by M. Brown Sequard, when the night bell was pulled violently. It was winter, and I confess I grumbled as I rose and went downstairs to open the door. Twice that week I had been aroused long after midnight for the most trivial causes. Once, to attend upon the son and heir of a wealthy family, who had cut his thumb with a penknife, which, it seems, he insisted on taking to bed with him, and once, to restore a young gentleman to consciousness, who had been found by his horrified parent stretched insensible on the staircase. D'Achillon in the one case and ammonia in the other were all that my patients required. And I had a faint suspicion that the present summons was perhaps occasioned by no case more necessitous than those I have quoted. I was too young in my profession, however, to neglect opportunities. It is only when a physician rises to a very large practice that he can afford to be inconsiderate. I was on the first step of the ladder, so I humbly opened my door. A woman was standing ankle deep in the snow that lay upon the stoop. I caught but a dim glimpse of her form, for the night was cloudy, but I could hear her teeth rattling like castanets, and, as the sharp wind blew her clothes close to her form, I could discern from the sharpness of the outlines that she was very scantily supplied with raiment. Come in, my good woman, I said hastily, for the wind seemed to catch eagerly at the opportunity of making itself at home in my hall, and was rapidly forcing an entrance through the half-open door. Oh, Min, you can tell me all you have to communicate inside. She slipped in like a ghost, and I closed the door. While I was striking a light in my office, I could hear her teeth still clicking out in the dark hall, till it seemed as if some skeleton was chattering. As soon as I obtained a light I begged her to enter the room, and, without occupying myself particularly about her appearance, asked her abruptly what her business was. My father has met with a severe accident, she said, and requires instant surgical aid. I entreat you to come to him immediately. The freshness and the melody of her voice startled me. Such voices rarely, if ever, issue from any but beautiful forms. I looked at her attentively, but, owing to a nondescript species of shawl in which her head was wrapped, I could discern nothing beyond what seemed to be a pale, thin face and large eyes. Her dress was lamentable. An old silk, of a color now unrecognizable, clung to her figure in those limp folds which are so eloquent of misery. The creases where it had been folded were worn nearly through, and the edges of the skirt had decayed into a species of irregular fringe, which was clotted and discolored with mud. Her shoes, which were but half concealed by this scanty garment, were shapeless and soft with moisture. Her hands were hidden under the ends of the shawl which covered her head, and hung down over a bust, the outlines of which, although angular, seemed to possess grace. Poverty, when partially shrouded, seldom fails to interest. Witness the statue of the Veiled Beggar, by Monti. In what manner was your father hurt? I asked, in a tone considerably softened from the one in which I put my first question. He blew himself up, sir, and is terribly wounded. Ah! He is in some factory, then? No, sir, he is a chemist. A chemist? Why, he is a brother professional. Wait an instant, and I will slip on my coat, and go with you. Do you live far from here? In the 7th Avenue, not more than 2 blocks from the end of this street. So much the better. We will be with him in a few minutes. Did you leave anyone in attendance on him? No, sir. He will allow no one but myself to enter his laboratory. And, injured as he is, I could not induce him to quit it. Indeed. He is engaged in some great research, perhaps? I have known such cases. We were passing under a lamp post, and the woman suddenly turned and glared at me with a look of such wild terror, that for an instant I involuntarily glanced round me under the impression that some terrible peril, unseen by me, was menacing us both. Don't ask me any questions, she said breathlessly. He will tell you all. But do, oh, do hasten. Good God! He may be dead by this time. I made no reply, but allowed her to grasp my hand, which she did with a bony, nervous clutch, and endeavored with some difficulty to keep pace with the long strides I might well call them bounds, for they seemed the springs of a wild animal, rather than the paces of a young girl with which she covered the ground. Not a word more was uttered until we stopped before a shabby, old-fashioned tenement house in the 7th Avenue, not far above 23rd Street. She pushed the door open with a convulsive pressure, and, still retaining hold of my hand, literally dragged me upstairs to what seemed to be a back offshoot from the main building, as high, perhaps, as the fourth story. In a moment more I found myself in a moderate-sized chamber, lit by a single lamp. In one corner, stretched motionless on a wretched pallet bed, I beheld what I supposed to be the figure of my patient. He is there, said the girl. Go to him. See if he is dead. I dare not look. I made my way as well as I could through the numberless dilapidated chemical instruments with which the room was littered. A French chafing dish supported on an iron tripod had been overturned, and was lying across the floor, while the charcoal, still warm, was scattered around in various directions. Crucibles, alembics, and retorts were confusedly piled in various corners, and on a small table I saw distributed in separate bottles a number of mineral and metallic substances, which I recognized as antimony, mercury, plumbago, arsenic, borax, etc. It was veritably the apartment of a poor chemist. All the apparatus had the air of being second-hand. There was no luster of exquisitely annealed glass and highly polished metals, such as dazzles one in the laboratory of the prosperous analyst. The makeshifts of poverty were everywhere visible. The crucibles were broken, or gallipots were used instead of crucibles. The colored tests were not in the usual transparent vials, but were placed in ordinary black bottles. There is nothing more melancholy than to behold science or art in distress. A threadbare scholar, a tattered book, or a battered violin is a mute appeal to our sympathy. I approached the wretched pallet bed on which the victim of chemistry was lying. He breathed heavily, and had his head turned toward the wall. I lifted his arm gently to arouse his attention. How goes it, my poor friend? I asked him. Here, are you hurt? In a moment, as if startled by the sound of my voice, he sprang up in his bed, and cowered against the wall like a wild animal driven to bay. Who are you? I don't know you. Who brought you here? You are a stranger. How dare you come into my private rooms to spy upon me? And as he uttered this rapidly with a frightful nervous energy, I beheld a pale distorted face, draped with long gray hair, glaring at me with a mingled expression of fury and terror. I am no spy, I answered mildly. Heard that you had met with an accident, and have come to cure you. I am Dr. Luxor, and here is my card. The old man took the card, and scanned it eagerly. You are a physician? He inquired distrustfully. And surgeon also. You are bound by oath, not to reveal the secrets of your patients. Undoubtedly. I am afraid that I am hurt, he continued faintly, half sinking back in the bed. I seized the opportunity to make a brief examination of his body. I found that the arms, a part of the chest, and a part of the face were terribly scorched, but it seemed to me that there was nothing to be apprehended but pain. You will not reveal anything that you may learn here? Said the old man, feebly fixing his eyes on my face, while I was applying a soothing ointment to the burns. You will promise me? I nodded assent. Then I will trust you. Cure me, I will pay you well. I could scarce help smiling. If Lorenzo de Medici, conscious of millions of ducats in his coffers, had been addressing some leech of the period, he could not have spoken with a loftier air than this inhabitant of the fourth story of a tenement house in the Seventh Avenue. You must keep quiet, I answered. Let nothing irritate you. I will leave a composing draft with your daughter, which she will give you immediately. I will see you in the morning. You will be well in a week. Thank God! Came in a murmur from a dusk corner near the door. I turned, and beheld the dim outline of the girl, standing with clasped hands, in the gloom of the dim chamber. My daughter! Screamed the old man, once more leaping up in the bed with renewed vitality. Who have seen her, then? When? Where? Oh, may a thousand cur, father! Father! Anything but that! Don't curse me! And the poor girl, rushing in, flung herself sobbing on her knees beside his pallet. Ah, brigand! You are there, are you? Sir, said he, turning to me, I am the most unhappy man in the world. Talk of Sisyphus rolling the ever-recoiling stone of Prometheus gnawed by the vulture since the birth of time. The fables yet live. There is my rock, forever crushing me back. There is my eternal vulture, feeding upon my heart. There. And, with an awful gesture of malediction and hatred, he pointed with his wounded hand, swathed and shapeless with bandages, at the cowering, sobbing, wordless woman by his side. I was too much horror-stricken to attempt even to soothe him. The anger of blood against blood has an electric power which paralyzes bystanders. Listen to me, sir, he continued, while I skin this painted viper. I have your oath. You will not reveal. I am an alchemist, sir. Since I was 22 years old, I have pursued the wonderful and subtle secret. Yes, to unfold the mysterious rose guarded with such terrible thorns, to decipher the wondrous table of emerald, to accomplish the mystic nuptials of the Red King and the White Queen, to marry them soul to soul, and body to body, forever and ever, in the exact proportions of land and water such has been my sublime aim, such has been the splendid feat that I have accomplished. I recognized at a glance, in this incomprehensible farrago, the argot of the true alchemist. Ripley, Flamel, and others have supplied the world, in their works, with the melancholy spectacle of a scientific bedlam. 2 years since, continued the poor man, growing more and more excited with every word that he uttered, 1 year since, I succeeded in solving the great problem in transmuting the baser metals into gold. None but myself, that girl, and God knows the privations I had suffered up to that time. Food, clothing, air, exercise, everything but shelter, was sacrificed toward the one great end. Success at last crowned my labors. That which Nicholas Flamel did in 1382, that which George Ripley did at Rhodes in 1460, that which Alexander Sethon and Michael Skudovogius did in the 17th century, I did in 1856. I made gold. I said to myself, I will astonish New York more than Flamel did Paris. He was a poor copyist, and suddenly launched into magnificence. I had scarce a rag to my back. I would rival the Medicis. I made gold every day. I toiled night and morning, for I must tell you that I never was able to make more than a certain quantity at a time, and that by a process almost entirely dissimilar to those hinted at in those books of alchemy I had hitherto consulted. But I had no doubt that facility would come with experience, and that ere long I should be able to eclipse in wealth the richest sovereigns of the earth. So I toiled on. Day after day I gave to this girl here what gold I succeeded in fabricating, telling her to store it away after supplying our necessities. I was astonished to perceive that we lived as poorly as ever. I reflected, however, that it was perhaps a commendable piece of prudence on the part of my daughter. Doubtless, I said, she argues that the less we spend, the sooner we shall accumulate a capital wherewith to live at ease. So, thinking her course a wise one, I did not reproach her with her niggardliness, but toiled on, amid want, with closed lips. The gold which I fabricated was, as I said before, of an invariable size, namely, a little ingot worth perhaps $30 or $45. In 2 years I calculated that I had made 500 of these ingots, which, rated at an average of $30 apiece, would amount to the gross sum of $15,000. After deducting our slight expenses for 2 years, we... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.